Adam Ward is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ward to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for nearly half of all executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, with Legal Analysts Larry Douglas, Jack Lee, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yanni. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dave Atwood. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons. Tonight's show will include an exclusive interview with Ward, taped recently on death row. The Execution Watch for Adam Ward begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. I am the host of Execution Watch. You're listening to KPFT Houston. If you've tuned in 90.1 FM in hopes of getting Palestra Palabra, you will find it on the HD channel, or you can go to the internet and seek it out there. It is on the air. But when Texas is executing people, this show takes precedence over the other things we do. That is a very serious issue. Stick with us after the show. Coming to America will be the show that follows us. In the meantime, we're going to be talking about the execution of Adam Ward. I think we have a call from Huntsville. Dave, is that you?
I'm here.
Well, where
up in Huntsville.
What's going on there?
Well, Ray, we've got about, I'd say, 20 or so people out here. The people are going across the street right now. The family's going across. The witnesses and the press have already gone across. And they're going across the street right now. And I'm here with Jeff Hood, well, the Reverend Jeff Hood, and a bunch of other people.
Before you toss it to Jeff, would you explain to our audience what the witnesses cross the road really means?
Well, what it means when they go across the road is that the execution is on and it's probably going to happen. And they won't go across the road if there's some real questions on whether it's going to happen or not. But the fact that they've gone all across the road, it probably means the execution will take place as scheduled, sadly enough.
Okay, well, I'll put Jeff on so that I can talk to him for just a minute.
Okay, I am going to do that. Here he is.
Hey, Ray.
Hey, Jeff Hood, Baptist minister.
Yes, sir. Standing out here looking at this tape, I'm seeing a barrier between persons of faith and the abolition of the death penalty. And it seems to me like people of faith should be crossing lines all over the state to end these executions. So,
well,
tonight...
Well, tell me, this is Holy Week. What is the special significance of that?
This is Holy Week, and certainly we're Christians are commemorating the final days of Jesus, the death and resurrection towards the end of the week, and certainly Jesus' life was always about crossing lines. And it seems to me that people of faith, Christians, need to do some more of it.
And what exactly do you plan to do in Huntsville tonight?
Well, as soon as we get off the phone, I plan to cross the line in front of me. And I'm sure I'll be arrested for trespassing. And I hope that it serves as a witness for what people of faith across the state should be doing. Again, crossing lines and abolishing the death penalty.
Chances are you're going to get arrested. Do you expect to be free tomorrow?
Prayerfully.
Okay. How about prayerfully calling me at my Ray on the Radio show on hmsnetradio.org, or if you're close to Houston, coming on board with me. But either way, telephone or present, we can discuss it.
Sure, I'll call you, Ray. Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck, Reverend. We hope your gesture has meaning.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye. And now we're going to Jennifer. Jennifer, are you there?
Yes, I am hearing you.
Whoops. I lost Jennifer. Get her back up. Get Jennifer back up and we'll talk to her. I'm sorry. Jennifer is heading the vigil here in Houston. Gives me a minute to talk to Jim. Jim, is this an ordinary case?
No, not by any stretch of the imagination. The best way I can say it, I have a real good friend I've known for years named Rafael Salazar, and he talks about people not being right in the head. And this is an example of somebody who was born who was not right in the head. In fact, he's on lithium when he's 4 years old and had mental problems throughout his entire life. It wasn't something he chose to do. That's just the way his brain chemistry worked. And the big issue that we've all been kicking around, that we've all been discussing, is what society's obligation when somebody through no choice of their own is born mentally ill, and then we take them and put them in jail and end up killing them. That's a real serious question. We should be facing moral questions.
Well, I want the audience to mull over that while I go to Jennifer. Where are you and what's going on there? Jennifer? Hello?
Yes.
Where are you and what's going on there?
Hi, Ray. This is Jennifer here. We're in Houston at our spa here, St. Stephen's Episcopal, several of us, West Alabama in Woodhead. I would just like to say that I met Mr. and Mrs. Ward, Adam's parents, the first time I went up to Polanski to visit a friend about 5 or 6 years ago, and my heart goes out to them. They have always been very helpful in their advice and to everyone who's come up there to visit friends and family, and my heart goes out to them, of course. Also to the victim, Michael Walker. I second the motion of what Reverend Jeff Hood said. We beat our chest about being conservatives here in Texas and wanting to protect religious values, religious liberty, and there's nothing conservative and or Christian about executing someone in the middle of the Holy Week. So that's my message today.
And your connection to the issue is through the Texas organization to abolish the death penalty?
Yes, www.pcadp.org.
Thank you, ma'am. And
thank
we'll
you.
Keep you posted.
Thank you, Ray.
Bye-bye. And that was Jennifer and Dave. Why don't we play the interview? You're getting ready to do that. I'm getting set up to do that. This is the interview I did with Adam Ward. Listen for yourself, and it will be broadcast on television after it's edited into this program on Houston Media Source, and I want you to look at him and in his eyes as he answers these questions, but for now, you get his voice. Tell me about your life before this case.
Well, I grew up in a small town called Commerce, Texas. East Texas State University was there before it was taken over by A&M Commerce. Outside of that, outside of a few liquor stores, it really wasn't much of a town. I grew up there. My dad's father used to be a professor at the college till he passed away before I was born. I'd grown up in that town. I'd gone to school there. I lived pretty much a normal life like everybody else in a small town. You know, I worked for my money, just went around, did different things, enjoyed life till June 13, 2005 happened, and then this started. You know, in small towns, you have a lot of politics that happen, and sometimes it's unbeknownst to you, and that also kind of leads up to the beginning of how this journey started, too.
Well, the case kind of invaded your life suddenly and severely.
Well, I went from going to school at Paris Junior College in Paris. I started off taking the jewelry program, then I went to HVAC, heating, vending, and air conditioning. Then I went to fluid power and motor controls classes and things like that. And I got to the point to where I was tired of going to school and paying somebody to talk at me instead of talk to me and not having a steady income. So at the time that all this had happened, I was taking some time off from going to school and pursuing finding a job, get some money in my pocket. That way I could do some other things in life. And everything was going just fine until the morning of June 13, 2005, and I was just doing what I normally do when all this happened.
And how long were you pre-trial?
I spent a little over 2 years in county. I had court-appointed attorneys. One of my attorneys was has an office across the street. His name was Dennis D. Davis. My second-chair attorney was, on his card, he says he was a senior retired criminal court district judge out of Houston. The process in which the representation was, it was deficient derelict from the get-go. That's pretty much common for small counties, especially in these processes.
Were you allowed to participate in the process, or were you just kind of the
victim
in the room?
No, I was not, and that's one of the problems that's one of the issues that I have, is that my trial attorneys did more to get me convicted than the district attorney's office did in many ways, and they had people that were working, they were supposed to have been on my defense team, they were actually lying and working against me. My trial attorneys, I told them I wanted to be a part of my case from the very beginning. They did what they wanted to, and they kept me out of the process, and part of the keeping me out of that process was trying to say that I was incompetent to stand trial, because the whole process was set up to take away from my credibility and my family's credibility so we could reveal what actually had happened and led up to this process. And I was kept from just about every working within the paperwork and all the process that was going on till the trial. I even told my attorneys that I wanted to get up and testify in my trial, and they kept telling me, okay, we're gonna have one more person, and then they closed before they ever gave me a chance to get up there.
And you had no previous criminal record?
No, so nothing really, just a few overnighters and a little 30-day stint, but no previous criminal history other than that.
Nothing that suffice separating you from the jury.
Yeah, one of the other issues, too, is how that I find interesting is now, years later, after the fact, I'm coming to find whenever I get trickle-down information from bits and pieces of information, copies of trial transcripts and different paperwork that was used during the trial, that somebody at some point in time has made up a fraudulent criminal history that was never there, and nobody's questioned that. There are many aspects that have not been looked at that need to be questioned in my case that have not been looked into, and a lot of things getting covered up.
The appellate process didn't raise all these?
No, it did not. And actually, to shine some light on part of the problem that's going on, my trial attorneys intentionally kept me out of the workings and the process of what was going on in my case at the time of trial. The lady that they had supposedly hired for my mitigation investigator, she had told me from the start that she wasn't going to have anything to do with my family, that she was just going to talk to me a few times. She was representing most of the people in that county that had capital cases that were pending trial. She would also had a bad habit of discussing other people's cases with other clients, which is a breach of ethics and wrong.
That's a minimal description of that.
And the investigator that they used, he did more to cover things up than he did to actually bring out things that were of factual relevance in my case. Now, another conflict of interest and things that should have been raised in my appellate process, which was not, which is also how things are done in small counties. My defense team had hired a lady named Christy Compton out of Dallas to do a lot of the testing that was supposed to be done for competency and placement of skills test. Ms. Compton was doing these tests, which should have been administered on a one-to-one basis ratio with the test taker and the test giver, and they had either the second chair attorney or they had the investigator there, which were trying to provoke reactions or disrupting what was going on. And, you know, there's some of that stuff that, quite honestly, I didn't know how to do, and they got to the point where they were saying, look, you're costing us too much money, so you're either going to hurry this up or we're going to make other things happen. The problem with what this lady did was she made fraudulent statements on the stand. It was supposed to be in behalf of my defense team, and Ms. Compton had also made these reports about my family by, what's the word I'm looking for? She had...
Why would anyone bring your whole family into this?
Well, she was doing like a... Not like... She was doing like a family history type background on my family. And she did it. She said a lot of things that were fraudulent, and they were actually harmful to me, because what they were trying to do, what the prosecution and my defense team were doing, is they took me to trial on a fraudulent, felonious issue that they made up, something that didn't happen, so that they could cause my case and turn it into being a capital case when it is not, because it does not make under the facts of what actually happened that day and the way things happened does not make under 19.03, section 19.03. They're going under obstruction and or retaliation, 36.06, which is obstruction and or retaliation, but it has in there, it has the word employee of, or public servant, I should say. Then whenever you look up the definition under the criminal codes of what a public servant is, he meets that. So Texas is using my case as a gateway case to make capital cases when it does not make. So they structured everything to... They had coached their witnesses, the state had coached their witnesses to make it appear as if I was obstructing and or retaliating for this man doing his job, which that did not happen. And then they were trying to say that I was being told what to do or being manipulated by my father or family or something like that. So they're trying to analyze my family and put a fraudulent scenario up there of things that aren't true. The problem with all of this is, besides them lying and all this, when this goes to the state habeas appellate process, Miss Lydia Brandt in Richardson, Texas, used a gal by the name of Tony Knox. Tony Knox came down here one time whenever I went through telling Miss Knox different people that were involved in my case. Her whole demeanor changed and she stopped whenever I ran across the name of Christy Compton. She said, "You're lying. I know you're lying. I'm personal and professional friends with this individual." I told her, "You can't work for me then, because that's a conflict. That's a serious conflict of interest." In these appellate process, they did the same thing as it whenever they took me to trial. They never once had me involved in the appellate process or within my trial. They would not share any type of trial transcripts. They wouldn't share any paperwork, what was going on, what they found, what they didn't find, so I didn't know if they were doing their job or not. The only thing they would send me was a little letter once a month telling me that they're working on my case. Well, that doesn't tell me what's going on when the problem is the attorney is supposed to be my mouthpiece in court. Whatever the attorney does, I'm held accountable for that. If they're derelict or deficient in their duties, I'm the one in the end that gets executed. I'm the one that pays the price. But the state of Texas sees that as long as they go through the paperwork, that you got a fair trial and you got a fair appellate process, they don't care what the truth is. Well, when you have all these different problems that are happening, there's a severe lack of justice, because the American public is naive of how the process really works. It's a big scam the way it's set up. It's just like the capital process. One of the things I've noticed was, like before all this happened, how many people ever have a conversation about capital cases, or what makes a capital case,
you're
or what
right.
the criteria of the capital case is. The
public wants to ignore all that because it's too ugly to think about.
Exactly. And most of the public does not know the difference, and they don't want to address it. And we are naive in the fact that we just want to have blind faith in our criminal justice system. And unfortunately, our criminal justice system is almost as corrupt as the criminals are, if not more so. Well, I look at it like this, and one of the things I've come to learn and find in all of this the hard way is I went from a life out there in the world of minding my own business, doing my own things, earning my money, going to school, trying to do the right things, to having the wrong name in the wrong town, and there's been so much derelict of justice in the facts being brought out and the way things are supposed to be done, that due to political ties, employees, I've been set up to have a case that is not capital, which my case is self-defense, only self-defense of the facts of what actually happened that day, to being manipulated into being a capital case and sent to death row, and my appellate process has been derelict of any type of justice in bringing out the truth.
Who is representing you now?
Mr. David R. Dow, unfortunately.
Okay.
Mr. Dow has come on my case at the federal level. He was at the Texas Defender Service when he originally picked up my case. He left Texas Defender Service and did not tell anybody till after he went back to the University of Houston. There was about 2 or 3 months before my case was supposed to go into federal district judges to be looked at. Nobody at any time would ever tell me what was going on in my case or share any information with me. He would send his staff up here to tell me that they're working on things or finding all this good information, but whenever I inquire as to what this information is, I'm never told as to what it is or what it pertains to. He would not even send me a copy or show me a copy of what he was filing ahead of time. I had to write to the judge and the clerk of the courts to get courtesy copies to even find out what was being done, and then there were things in there that were drastically wrong, and still to this day, I don't even know what Mr. Dow is doing on my case. He has refused to step down before this, and he is having minimal contact with me, so I don't even know what he's doing other than he's planning on filing something at the last minute, which I'm not comfortable with because me and him have a severe conflict of interest. He's done some things that have been questionable, and he has lied to me as to being able to find witnesses, things like that my people have found. We've had to go out and collect evidence that he hasn't done. I mean, if you were sitting here on death row and your life is in the hands of your attorney, and your attorney comes up here and tells you that they are not going to do any type of investigation or anything else on your work till the court grants money for it, how would you feel? Because that's exactly what I was told. So
okay.
I had to
how
go.
How long have you actually been on the road?
Been a little over 8 years.
A little over 8 years. That's not long in comparison to, I mean, Gus is here 20 years, 30 years.
And I wish he was still here. He was a good fellow, and I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I interviewed him in his very same booth, and he's a soft-spoken, articulate, 41-year-old guy that still looks like a kid.
Well, there's a couple things that I want to bring out as far as things that are wrong. You know, one of the things that needs to be looked at is our judicial system. People, there needs to be an awareness on how wrong it's being done, such as in my case. The day that all of this happened, I was washing my car, just doing everything I normally do, when this man comes up, which was, I don't know what his problem was that day, but he seemed like he was either intoxicated or high, but he wasn't acting rationally. This man acted outside the law in what he did that day, in the way he acted. I was not the aggressor. He was the aggressor the whole time. The facts of what actually happened that day, I've never had a chance to bring out. My side has never been heard of what happened. The state has gone out of their way to lie, to embellish things that could never happen. When everything got down to what actually happened, this man was the one that came to where I lived. He was the one threatening me and my family and my neighbors. He's the one that left. He came back as the aggressor. He is the one that pushed things to where it goes, to where it went. Under the law, a person has a right to defend themselves force with force, if necessary. Everything was verbal up to the point that it progressed past that. And the only thing I ever did that day was try to get this man under control in an uncontrolled situation of a person that would not have it any other way. This man made the choice, a choice that changed my life, changed my family's life, my friends' lives, and his children's lives. There are things that I have problems with that have been done since then. If anybody is capable of reading the first 2 days of my trial transcripts of the state's witnesses, and you look and you go, if you you're able to read a copy of the state's medical examiner, Dallas County Medical Examiner's report of this man, of his autopsy, and then you can also cross-reference that with such as if you have access to the internet, such as Google Earth, Google Maps or so, and you look at the area, there is physically impossible for any of the state's witnesses to seen what they said they seen. The state has lied and had to coach their witnesses into saying that I had said things that were not said, or had done things or been in places that I could not have been. People watch things such as CSI or FBI files, and they think everything is such a cut and dry science, and it's not. And everybody thinks that the cops do what they're supposed to. The day that all this happened, the only thing I did was defend myself and try to defend my family and neighbors. There was only, as I said in court, there were only 3 shots that were fired by me in self-defense after this man pulled a gun on me. That fact has never come out. The state has embellished the fact, trying to say that this man was shot 9 times. It's physically impossible for him to be shot 9 times with the firearm that was used that day. Also, the other thing that was never said was, and hasn't been brought out, is that the magazines were lost by the Commerce PD. They were run over. There are still rounds jammed in those magazines. If my attorneys had done their job and raised adequate issues, that would have disproved most of what the state was trying to say of 7 to 9 shots. The state claims that there was a shot through the window of this truck. They also say that there was a shot in the back tire. That is physically impossible for that model of firearm in its magazine. It is a single stack sheet metal magazine. It is not a staggered high capacity magazine. With the rounds that are still jammed in there, that would also alleviate the amount that was shot. That would also show that there's a problem, that there's fraud in the state's case and with what their witnesses say. Also, another thing that was also not brought out in all this, what the medical examiner's testimony was, she even said there are rounds that cannot be explained. There are shots that cannot be explained in this body. One of them was, I believe that the state and the local cops there had taken a firearm or taken a firearm and put holes in this body after the fact to try to cover up what had happened that day.
Well, do you have any speculation why anybody would want to do all this to you?
Had the wrong name in the wrong town. That's part of it.
So there's a family history probably involving law enforcement?
Well, as I was saying, in small-town politics, there was, I was diagnosed as being bipolar and dyslexic, I think, like age 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm.
And the school district there was like most school districts. They wanted to do what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. and they made their money off athletics. They did not care about agriculture or academics.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in that. In sports, I was into ag and some academics and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
My parents had tried to get the school district to do what they were supposed to as far as implementing the process.
So it involved your education and
yes, well, they tried to get them to implement the what's the word I'm looking for?
Procedures?
Yes, the procedures and things that they're supposed to do to compensate for those learning problems.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my problem is with reading and writing and short-term memory. As far as things mechanical or physical or stuff like that, I had no problem with it. But at that time, the superintendent runs the school board, so school board runs the city council, and the city council runs everybody else. So, at a young age, there was politics and political stuff that was going on. they had tried to blame some stuff on me that had happened whenever I was in school before I did a junior senior, doubled up on 1.5 credits. They used to force me out. But due to the things, due to the pressures that my parents had put on the system, there were people that wanted retribution and payback, and they looked for it any way they could get it. But one of the things that I wanted to bring...
They're pretty extreme in McKinney, Texas.
Well, I was from Commerce, Texas.
Pretty extreme in Commerce, Texas.
Well, the other thing, too, is that there's another aspect of all this that has not been looked at, and that is that one of the things that needs to be a light be brought to is when you're dealing with small-town politics and friends of friends and things like that, the day that all of this had happened, there were things that had happened that could directly affect my case that were never looked at. My attorneys had intentionally ignored. Half the crime scene there was not cordoned off and looked at. There was a cop that had removed this man's firearm and had removed evidence from the scene. But one of the main things that needs to be brought out that I have questions to, that I have a real problem with, is the fact that there was a man that is the adopted father of this man that died. And the day that he was there, he used to be in charge of a thing called E-Corps, Emergency Response Corps in Commerce. What this man did that day when he showed up was threaten me and my life, my family's life. He also went over to this man that was shot, and he refused to allow the EMTs to work on this man. And what he did was medical malpractice. Now, there's a reason for all of this that I found out later. He was also good friends, supposedly, with the district attorney's office, with the head district attorney at the time. The head district attorney helped him get custody of these kids. What my problem is he was a known convicted sex offender, a child molester. He didn't have to register till I was in state habeas. And I found out when I was in county that this man had raped this guy, was molesting him whenever he was a child. This man that died also has... It's also been found out after the fact that he has a history of violent behavior. 3 days before this, he had acted out irrationally and scared a female that was a professor there in that town at the college. 3 days prior to this, she was having some trees professionally cut down in her yard, her property, and he had acted out, and she had called his employers, and they did nothing about it. But now, where I'm going with this is, the district attorney helped this man get custody of these kids. If he was doing all this, he had means, motive, and opportunity, because what he did was he refused the EMTs to work on him, because if they had transported him right then and worked on him properly, the man could still be alive. That would take the capital murder and death penalty right off the table. Also, by getting custody of those kids, and the kids being minors, he was able to get spend the life insurance policy, then turn around and put fraudulent wrongful death suits on me and my family and the county and other people like that. Not to mention, he's putting these children were put at harm at a young age, and that's supposed to be illegal in the state of Texas for a person to have a record like that, to have custody of minors such as that. These are all dirty dealings that were never brought out and haven't been looked at that could directly impact my case.
Well, everything that you've described only communicates to me that right now you need the best kind of legal representation to get your hands on, and you don't think you've got that.
And I don't. If I had an attorney, I have so many issues that any attorney that has, it's an anti-death penalty attorney that has any interest, could do so many things. That's just like whenever I went to trial, the chain of custody was broken. You have people that were perjuring themselves. My attorney, Mr. Dowles, and his staff had told me that one of my key witnesses, we can't find them. We don't even think they're in the state, but we promise, we swear, we've looked for them. We can't find them.
Well,
it took my parents less than 20 minutes of internet search to find them.
You understand that I'm in radio, and who is God in radio is the clock.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just run out of time.
All right.
And everything you said will be broadcast. And I'll get my lawyers, who don't have a hand in the game, to analyze it.
Well, there's things that need to be... People need to understand just how much of a lapse of what people think happens to what really happens in cases. I see people in here all the time that have legitimate issues that could prolong their appeals process and they should get action on, that don't get raised because attorneys don't want to raise it. They want to file the same brief and just change a name on it. And they don't raise factual issues.
The Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, Scalia, who just died, is famous for saying, there's nothing wrong with executing innocent people if they were properly tried and properly convicted. And I think that paints a whole picture. Thank you very much for the interview.
Well, I appreciate your time.
And do we have your permission to broadcast this?
Certainly.
And we are, in fact, broadcasting that unedited exactly as we heard it. And you will not only be able to hear it, but in a few days or weeks, you'll be able to see it because it will be posted to Houston Media Source Archive and to the executionwatch.org website. Jim, what do you think about that?
I'm reminded of Nancy Reagan just died, as you know, and there was a biography written about her, and the first page said, had a birth certificate, and said everything on there except her sex is false. You just heard the very same thing about a delusional person because the facts are real simple. This family had a lot of problems with the city, a lot of problems with the school board. They were real paranoid about people coming to get them. They were hoarding guns, hoarding food, and they had their house messed up, and the city had been giving them citations for not cleaning up their property. A code enforcement officer, who they aren't armed, they just enforce the codes, came by, did not stay on the property to photograph it. There was a confrontation. This man goes in the house, comes with a 45, and shoots a man 9 times who is unarmed. And that's what the record shows at trial. Everybody says that, of course, except him. And the problem you have with this interview, it's a classic example of, like, the beautiful mind. Somebody can be pretty bright, but just be really crazy. And the guy's delusional and is very paranoid because you'll notice everybody's at fault but him. Everyone's at fault of him.
And it's a conspiracy.
It's a conspiracy. Everybody's after him. The city's after him. Nobody, you're not that important to be everybody in the world to be after you. And everybody's fault. All the lawyers are bad. David Dow's well-respected lawyer. I read this transcript. This county.
Who was the judge from Harris County in this case?
There's no judge in Harris County. I don't recall. It may have been second chair, but the county spent $136,000 paying for experts to testify in his trial on his behalf. If you read the transcript and read what happened in this case, the city of Corsicana, not Corsicana, but Commerce, they spent tons of money at school trying to help this kid. The father kept interfering because of his paranoia. The courts appointed him good lawyers. They did everything they could possibly do. They spent a hunt to give him $130,000 to hire experts. David Dow, who's one of the best appellate lawyers in the country, is doing his appeal, and yet all of them are at fault, all of them are wrong, he's right. It's a classic example of someone being paranoid, and everybody's at fault but him. You'll notice nobody except him and his family is correct in this entire scenario. That just simply isn't possible.
Should we have killed him?
No. That's what we should have a discussion on, because this kid started out, he was on lithium at the age of 4. He's diagnosed as being bipolar. And among other things. And he was on lithium at 4, had been seeing different medical professionals throughout his entire life. This was not something that he chose.
Well, he said that his trial lawyers wanted to try issue of his competency.
Well, they had competence hearings. They had competency hearings. That's the whole mitigating. They brought all the information about his problems out during the trial itself to try to mitigate the evidence. They brought all of that out.
Did the jury hear all of it?
The jury heard every bit of it. The jury heard all of this. Like I say, it's been $130,000 on expert psychologists who testified on behalf of the defense. They heard every bit of this stuff. And the big problem is, he was born, his brain wasn't working right. His father exacerbated his mental problems by reinforcing his bad conduct.
Hold on, Jim. Yes, Dave.
Hi, Ray. Well, the witnesses are coming out right now. so it's over as far as I can tell.
Do you have any loose Baptist preachers around there? Do they pack them off?
That Baptist preacher was taken out of here about 15, 20 minutes ago. They even gave him a ride in the front seat of the car, but they took him out.
Okay.
So he's not here anymore. I take it over at the Walker County Jail or close by. So we'll probably know a little bit more later on, but that's all we know about the Reverend Jeff.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. You take care.
Well, Adam Ward is dead. My name is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch. We are on KPFT in Houston, and Adam Ward has been killed by the state of Texas, and we're discussing the efficacy of that action. Jim just got through saying that maybe we shouldn't be killing crazy people.
Well, see, that's not a matter of choice. It's not killing redheaded people. If you're born, if your brain's not working right, that's no choice. You don't choose that. You don't choose when you're a fetus who gets to be your parents, nor do you choose what kind of mind you're going to get. His brain didn't work at the very beginning. At the very beginning, he had problems. Even as a child, he had problems.
School system tried to straighten it out, and the family wouldn't let them.
Family
right?
wouldn't. They would threaten to sue. They would interfere. The father was as delusional as he was about these people trying to get him. The city was trying to get him. The reason he claimed he shot, because he confessed after the shooting, the reason he claimed he shot the man is because after they had an argument over him taking photographs of the property, they had an argument. At that point, the kid goes in the house and gets a gun. He claims that he sees him making a phone call to call the police, and they're going to come and kill him. And that's why he shoots him.
Okay, swing the microphone over to Larry, and let's get an alternative, or at least Larry. Larry, what do you think about this?
Well, it's a tragic case, Ray, as all of these are. Adam Ward was delusional, but there are a lot of delusional people walking around, not killing people every single day. The problem is...
And Jim's favorite line is, the only job available should be a district court judge in a criminal section.
The problem is that Adam Ward killed Michael Walker. And
Pee-wee Walker.
Michael Pee-wee Walker.
Michael Pee-wee Walker.
And so it's a matter of... So we have to decide what, as a society, do we do about that.
Well, you're lawyers. I mean, Jim, Larry, Paige, Jack, Mike, you're down in the courthouse. What do we do?
Well, we simply follow the law, okay? And under our system of laws, once the district attorney decides to seek the death penalty in Texas, in a case like this, the death penalty is likely to be...
The jury is qualified on the ability and willingness to do, in a proper case, kill somebody.
In any criminal case, the jury has to be willing to follow the law. And if the follow the law means return a death penalty in a decision in an appropriate case, then that's what the jury is required to do. But the prosecutor has a great deal of discretion to decide, what should we do in this case? Now, in his case, I guess the family had some notoriety within the community, because there was one teacher, I understand, who testified, and she had kept for well over 15 years materials regarding his being abusive to her, because of the fear that the family is going to come back and sue the school district. There was also I think the school district also advised one teacher to always have a witness present whenever was it a witness, a lawyer. I actually have a lawyer present whenever you talk to these people.
That's a little extreme.
So it makes you wonder, okay,
Paige,
what was going on in Commerce.
Paige, these two guys on my right here have determined that this guy was destined to be executed from the age of 2 forward. And that's not necessarily a good or a right thing to do, but that's what's happened. What's your take?
Well, he, because of his mental illness and because it was so widespread, if it was not treated correctly, then it is inevitable that he would go ahead and end up in the situation he found himself. And the facts in this case show that he was never treated correctly.
Are there not a bunch of other people out there that can't recall words on immediate recall that we don't execute?
Well, but that's not his problem. Okay, his problem is that he's schizophrenic. He's bipolar. He has major depression. He has narcissistic personality disorder.
And he's got a gun.
And he's got a gun. Now, those are his problems. It's not that he can't just recall a word.
Well, is
Paige, I'm going to say something here. It wasn't the fact that the officials didn't treat him right. The parents interfered. Every time the parents tried to do something, the father come running in and stopped it. So what happened, the father was one primarily responsible for him not getting the sort of treatment that he wanted. In fact, the father should be on the one on being
executed. If it takes a village to raise a kid, you got to let the village do that.
Exactly, and the father wouldn't do it. I mean, when he gets so bad that he's so confrontational with the school, they have to have teachers hiring a lawyer to even talk to him. You know what you're dealing with, and so he exacerbates what this kid was born with.
Well, there was an agency employed by the school district to construct their special education programs. And there was a dedicated course of special education treatment mapped out
for him.
And his father refused to let his son participate.
So it wasn't,
and threatened anyone who attempted treat him.
It wasn't that they were mad that he didn't play football, when he wanted to milk cows, it was beyond that.
Oh, it was way beyond that.
Jack, you got anything to add to this discussion?
Everybody's a little bit delusional. Everybody.
Well, I work on it. Every time I take this leg
That's
off.
That's the basis of marriage, Jack.
Right. Yeah. Every time I take this leg off, I imagine that it didn't go away.
We're all a little delusional. It's just, you know, his parents and what I do know about and what I've read about is about his father reinforced. If this kid weren't naturally delusional, his father made absolutely sure he would be delusional. I mean, for crying out loud, when I was growing up, if my parents got a phone call from the school, can I say ass whooping?
Yeah, you
okay.
Say ass
whooping. The ass whooping I would get at home was was gonna be astronomical. What was all the bad things that the school could throw at me was insignificant to what I was gonna get at home. And at a very early age, I learned I needed to behave. And what his father apparently did was encouraged his misbehavior. When anything happens, we will blame other people. It's not you, my perfect child. It is somebody else at fault. When you reinforce that, a child simply decides, you know what, I can do no wrong. And I can threaten, which Adam Ward did, threaten his teachers with, oh yeah, if you do this, I'll tell my parents, and we'll sue you.
Okay, let's switch over to Michael. Michael, you practice law in Cloverleaf and Channelview, and I grew up in Cloverleaf and Channelview, and they got hoarders, and they've got conspiracy theory. You actually know this case from personal practice.
They're my personal clients. I think this is the type of people that make the world an interesting place.
How do you keep them all alive?
I keep them alive by, quite frankly, I think everybody needs a way to vent, and sometimes what our practice is...
So they go to their lawyer's office?
Is to vent, and you explain to them how the system works, and that the reason it hurts them, in the big run, it helps society more by these things happening.
But, Mike, you can't talk somebody out of paranoia.
You can't, and that's the problem with it. You can hear what he talked about. He blames everybody. The interesting thing to me on this case is the big issue. What do we do with people like this? And what I say, and the conversation to this morning, this evening, has been about the right of a prosecutor to make that decision on life and death. I don't think it's a prosecutor's job. I think it needs to be a higher power than the prosecutor. The prosecutor can determine if you committed that crime, but the prosecutor should not be the one to decide on life and death. It's an unfair scenario. Now, the interesting thing about this case is we haven't talked about one angle to it, that there was almost a jury misconduct claim that would have avoided this. And what happened in this case is because this is a small town and people are interested in this, there was a man who followed this trial and came to every court case and knew the DA.
And made notes.
Now, the fact remains is one day during lunch, he was sitting at a table and the jurors sat with him. It's an awkward situation. The awkward part that people don't realize is even though you can't talk to the jurors, sometimes by saying nothing, you're sending a message. This man did a neutral thing. He said, we can't talk about the trial. Nobody talked about the trial, and they made jokes about it. That was brought to the judge's attention, but there was no hard evidence that anything happened. And without any hard evidence, they let it be. But that's a tricky scenario when you happen to be sitting with jurors.
Jim, what happened to the appellate lawyers on that issue?
The issue is real simple. You got to show some harm. And there's no harm because of what called the jury tampering is when outside evidence comes into the jury and there is no evidence discussed at the table. What happened is a professor at that college in commerce, they knew some of the jurors, knew everybody in town. And he was eating, and the restaurant was kind of crowded. Some of the jurors sat down with him. And they said, he said something to the effect of one of the jurors, we can't talk about the case. And just laughed, and that was it. Nothing was ever discussed. Because the only way you can ever have a case reversed when something like that happens, if that person brings in outside evidence, the jury relies upon it.
Appearances don't get it. What's the standard to get it?
It's got to be outside evidence, material evidence, that's brought into the jury room from a source other than the witness stand. And you got to show that you were harmed by it. And that never happened in this case. They simply sat down. They said, we can't talk about it. They laughed, and that was basically it.
But yet the lawyer making the motion did the right thing because he aired out. It was decided. There was no harm.
It's all part
of
the record.
He did his job. It was part of the record. He did everything he was supposed to do. And I did see one case in Harris County get reversed on that because somebody left a newspaper in the jury room. Well, with a newspaper, well, that's hard evidence. There was evidence given to the jury that was nothing to do with the case. But that's what they're looking for. And in this case, nobody said anything. There was nothing they could have done. And we got this problem in Harris County all the time. Well, not as much anymore with the new courthouse, but we used to go up and down the elevators with jurors and witnesses all the time. It was a common practice.
And they've recently changed the grand jury selection process in Harris County. But I'm going to save that discussion for later on because this is one program in a series of multimedia programs that are coming up. You're going to be able to see this whole program on videotape because over here in the corner is Mark Pirtle, who is a wizard at making tapes of all of that, and he's going to turn this into a video so you can see this discussion and you can see my interview with Adam. And I think that's a very important thing to do. But in addition to that, a couple of Thursdays from now, not tomorrow or this Thursday, but the next Thursday, we're going to gather a Houston media source and we're going to talk about who should be responsible for making the decision to apply capital punishment on a case-to-case. And there's a diversity of views about that among the lawyers around this table, and that will be broadcast live, and you can get that on www.hmstv.org, and where it says
nobody can bring guns.
And nobody can bring
the first
guns.
Rule.
Well, it's a sign on the wall that says no guns.
Okay, then we'll be safe.
I will holster my finger gun.
Okay. Well, draw a picture of it. Because we have learned recently that Jack Lee is very good at drawing pictures.
Yes. I'll be drawing some pictures.
And they will show up on the archive. But let me tell you, I don't like having to do this show. I do, however, enjoy the show immensely because I never come into the studio or never go to death row and interview anybody without expanding my understanding of the world that I live in. Sometimes it's ugly. A lot of time it's cruel. Many times it's thoughtless. And yes, from time to time we actually do kill completely innocent people. And some of that innocence may have to do with how mentally culpable they are. And at other times, it may have to do with how the testimony and the evidence is twisted to get that conviction. Execution Watch is probably as important an effort as I have ever put forth in media. And this is where I have lived most of my life. I appreciate the audience. I'm so glad that you're listening. I need your feedback. You can send emails through our Facebook page and let me know what you think. Just look up Execution Watch on Facebook and it's there. I couldn't do this show without the assistance of our capable producer, Elizabeth Stein. She and I have lunch and scream at one another to no end per time. Technical director is Otis McClay. I talked to him today. He's listening and has some ideas that we're going to add to the webpage later on. Bob Gardner and team is in there pushing the buttons and flipping the switches, and I'm glad to see that. The music you hear is Victoria Panetti. The next scheduled execution is John Battaglia. I have interviewed John. He went in a different direction from Adam with his interview. He wanted to talk about everything but his case, and when you listen to that, you may understand why he didn't want to talk about his case. Our vigil reporters were Jennifer Simmons here in Houston and the ever-wonderful Dave Atwood in Huntsville. And we're all worried about what the preacher's doing in Walker County Jail overnight. This is
probably
Ray Hill
collecting money like most preachers
saying thank you very much for listening to Execution Watch in the memory today of Adam Ward.